Hey folks, welcome to the Wrench Turners Podcast, the show that's about improving the life, well-being, and productivity of mechanics everywhere. I am your host, Mr. Joshua Taylor, founder of Wrench Turners, and today we get to talk to a special guest. He is an import, as it were, from the UK, spent almost 20 years here in Canada, is licensed in both the UK and here in Canada, spent a large quantity of time at a Chrysler store, and in actuality, he was at the National Chrysler Master Tech Championship. It's like a tournament, so to speak. The top 20 in all of Canada get invited to this event back in 2010. Guess what? I did the same thing 2 years prior, so we share that in common, and good sir, that's awesome. So without further ado, Andrew King, let's get into it. So sir, I really appreciate you coming on the show, appreciate you giving us the time and sharing a little bit about your life experiences in the trade and what it's been like. I'm really excited to hear a bit about your time in the UK before coming here. You know, recently we had a gentleman, Mike Abel, on the show, who's a motorcycle mechanic in the UK. He's in a little town. I think little is the appropriate word from where he is, but I think it's Norwich, if I say it correctly. Correct me, Mike, if I say it wrong, but looking forward to getting into it. So Mike, tell us a little bit about what got you into the trade.
Honestly, so education's a little different in England. We finish high school at 16. So college for us, like your community college, is your stepping stone to university. Or you do vocational, or just go out into the real world and do whatever you can get for jobs. So myself, I studied business for 2 years until I was 18 and decided that business, economics, IT, way too many people in the UK, especially in Europe, with the free roam of visas, people were able, there was too much competition. I'm never going to have a job. I'll be like somebody with an art degree, right? So, I decided.
If my sister's listening, she might not have, I might not have good things to say about that, but.
So I decided for a trade. Sparky, plumber, mechanic. Sparky, I figured I would probably kill myself. Plumber, I didn't want to deal with people's shit. Mechanic, reality is everyone is lazy. You'll have a job for life, and look where it's got me. It's got me halfway across the world, and it's got me the other half of this country. So I can't complain about that.
That's awesome. Now, somebody might say that even though a plumber might be dealing with people's shit, some might say as a mechanic, you're kind of doing the same thing.
Absolutely. Looking back on it now, yes. And I probably would have been more financially would have been better to be a plumber, I'd say, especially with some of the call out fees.
Right. Now, because you were, you had an interesting choice that you made between either going to, whether not necessarily community college, but just going to university and then choosing to go into a trade. Was there any pull? Like, did you have family in the trades? Did you have friends in the trade? Was there any pull at all? Or was it just kind of
It was just me and my friends. We used to do, like, we would do our own audio installs. Like, I was the dumbass that I would try and what the first time I had a Peugeot 106. It was a 91 106. I tried to wire my sub amp. Connected to the battery, try and feed it through the firewall. Wonder why it's sparking. Like, that's how stupid I was with regards to automotive. Completely oblivious, but all me and my friends, we helped each other. We did the audio system. Like, I had like 12 speakers in the back parcel shelf of my Mark III Golf. Absolutely loved doing that. And that was just kind of just where the tinkering came from. But from a family aspect, I had nobody in the trade.
Interesting. Interesting. There's been so many folks that we've had on the show that were some kind of family or familial relation of some description, whether uncle or grandfather, father, or some kind of family relation that got them into the automotive business. Yep. It's interesting that you had none.
I had nobody in it. Like, I got family in Scotland, a couple of them construction trades, but nobody in this automotive industry whatsoever. And I feel as though maybe my first job is what set me up for success for going forward.
So what was that?
So that was my first job was a little small shop. It was called Sterling Motor Services. Just a one-man band, as or independent traders can also be called. And it was just the guy that my mum worked with, his wife, and he was looking for somebody to give him kind of like a shop hand, but start an apprenticeship. And I got in there, and within 6 months, my apprenticeship started. I've gone from the lube kid to now doing head gaskets, doing timing belts. Like, timing belts are a big thing over there. Might not be now, like with more modern engines, but back then you were doing timing belts pretty much every single day of the week. But it was just, there you go, bats was in the fire. Like, here, take this out, take this apart, you know, talking me through the intricates and setting me for success just with doing it right, take it apart, talk it, you know. I wasn't allowed to use air tools for my first 2 years.
Wow.
You know, like, you could remove wheels, you could remove like a stock hub nut or whatever, but he wanted me to get a feel for stuff, because I remember my first tie rod, it was on a Nissan, I think it was an Altima, and I was double wrenching. Snap. And then, of course, hard lessons. What the F are you doing? Blah, 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 blah. Made me learn the understanding, but, you know, pay attention. Like, you know, if it doesn't feel right, ask, you know. I always say, like I've said to my apprentices previously, no such thing as a stupid question. I might laugh at you, but at least you're asking the question. Ignorance. Sorry, that's where you're going to get in trouble, right?
Yes. Yes, and I think there is only one stupid question, and that's the one that's not asked, right?
Exactly.
That's the big thing. You've talked about feel as an apprentice. Learning feel is key. The fact that it was, okay, yes, we're going to say – yes, you can take tires off with the air, and yes, you can maybe do something like super heavy duty, like a hub or whatever, but everything else, you're going to have to learn feel. And the faster you learn feel, the faster you're going to get better at everything else we do, because I don't think I've ever been able to successfully explain the sensation that you feel just before you know something is going to snap, or just before you know something is going to twist, and it's not. Something is going to stay moving. Something is going to start moving, and it's not the thing that's supposed to be doing it.
Yeah.
That sensation is so. I don't think I can. I genuinely don't think I can explain it. You have to just learn it, and unfortunately, in order to learn it, you have to break stuff in order to learn it, because otherwise, and you don't know where that limit is.
Absolutely, and you know, when you're when you're at a larger dealership level, you know, you have that. You have that ability to swallow those costs, those learning mistakes. This was his pocket. Like, it was, he literally had everything on the line. So any costly mistake, he might as well literally have just been paying it straight out of his own pocket that day. So it made me more aware and set me up for that, for the future.
Now that's an interesting dynamic. I didn't have to deal with that kind of failure anxiety, because that now becomes something that you as an apprentice are thinking of, right? Like, it's something you're cognizant of, especially those that have the mentality and care about their boss, their leader, the shop owner, whoever, right? Because there are some folks out there, you know, going back 20 years, I've worked with apprentices as a licensed tech over my years. There are some that don't care, and there are some that will. And it's very difficult to suss out an apprentice. I would say it's easier to figure out, what's the right phrase, the quality of a man, as it were, as a licensed technician or an experienced technician than it is an apprentice. Because I look at apprentices as any technician, because different countries have different standards, regulations, licensure, and so on and so forth. I look at an apprentice as anybody that hasn't turned a wrench for more than 5 years. 5 years and under, you're an apprentice. I don't care what country you're in, you're an apprentice. You are still learning without a doubt. Those individuals are really hard to read, because they haven't had enough time to truly been through enough shit to be educated, to be experienced, and to be clear I guess, yep. You get wishy-washy answers. You're not really sure what they mean, not really sure what they're saying. They're still learning who they are, because the most of the time those apprentices are also under the age of 25. Like, especially as men, we don't develop our brain. Our brain is not fully developed until 25, period. That is a biological fact. So yep. We're not that bright before 25, period. So it's difficult to understand who we are. So you got an independent, you had, I would say, a fairly immense amount of pressure in that circumstance. But he wanted to teach you through feel, through experience. And you dived, he put you right into the deep end right off the bat with timing belts and so on. So you were doing some heavy duty work. So what was that? Was the rest of that first year the same way? Was it always like that?
No. It was a gradual introduction. So he had me just kind of start off the first little basics of just doing oil changes. First basics was just the oil changes, and then progressing to some other small minor services. And then it would progress to the point of, so in England, we would have what's called full service, which is trying to think back to it now. It's basically air filter plugs, fuel filter, because we still had a lot of vehicles that had inline fuel filters. You would do an oil change with it too. Typically, it included a brake service, tire rotation, and I'm probably forgetting a lot because, like I say, this has been a long time since I did it, but that was typical. So then you would book those in, mm-hmm. and then, hey, you're going to do that. And then get me into the inspection process, looking, keeping your eyes open. Even if you're not, you're bringing in for a rear brake noise, you got it in the air, give it a little shake, without knowing what flat rate was, because I had never heard of it in England. Come over to Canada and say, hey, we're going to pay you flat rate. All right, what's that? He had set me up again, just all these little building blocks that without me, now uh-huh. I think back to it, these were the building blocks that he gave me, which, was awesome. Carrying on for the full services, then it would be do a clutch. Obviously, back then, automatics were significantly less. I remember being in school and them saying essentially that you might as well, like our interpretation in school of an automatic transmission was, it was like wizardry. Don't touch it. You're going to screw it up. Don't touch it. Send it to a gearbox specialist. That's who deals with it. Okay. But we'll happily take apart, a manual transmission, change individual gear, change stuff. Just that was the thought process with automatics. So anyways, he would get me doing the clutches and then progress it. Okay. Do engines. Like do a re and re, do head gaskets, obviously timing belts. A lot of failures come from those. GM had an engine in the, what was it, middle 90s to early 2000s was the Ecotex. So the 1.4, the 1.6, 1.8, mm-hmm. and 2 liter. 40,000 miles was their interval. 42,000, you were on the hook. And it was just great. It sucks from a customer's perspective, but for me, it's great. There I am, like tearing apart stuff, he had a buddy that had
said before we started hitting record, it's job security, right?
Exactly, right? he had a buddy that had a TVR Cerbera. So TVR is like a kit car. Used to be a British.
Isn't that the car that was in Swordfish?
The what?
Isn't the TVR Cerbera the car that was in Swordfish with John Travolta? Isn't that super special thing? It was such a crazy car to see and awesome. Sorry,
No problem. Had a Land Rover V8 in it, so he had some engine issues. I believe his head stud actually fractured, and so we ended up having to drill it out, learn how to actually do a helicoil or time cert. Whatever phrase you want to use, physically measuring because it had bucket shims.
Now, time cert.
Yep.
Real quick pause. Time cert. I didn't start hearing the phrase time cert until I started working with a technician who'd been around the block about 18 times. So the owner of the shop that I worked at the power sports store, he used time cert. And that was the first time I'd ever heard helical phrased as a time cert. Was that because it was a British thing? Because he was heavy into Triumph, heavy into like old what did he call? BSP, BS, BSA,
BSA,
the old, like the BSA. Old British bikes that he
the old like Royal
loved,
Enfield stuff
working on. Yes, yeah, no, he loved working on that old stuff.
That was something from back then, and it was just little names that go back and forth. And obviously now with social media and so forth, you hear a lot more phrases that are becoming more the norm that mix between the two.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But
now, once but you yeah, got so was... you got through that first year, you were learning a whole lot. It was you're doing a little bit of everything. You're doing head gaskets. You're doing engines. You're doing clutches. You're doing all kinds of that stuff. So again, super different than my own first couple of years. I got the benefit of having a great foreman who, you know, weekly, bi-weekly, we did all kinds of challenges after work, but I seldom did anything during the workday.
Yeah.
Multiple service managers. I had 4 service managers in 2.5 years. I was at the first store. So not a very consistent set of leaders. You had the same person for 2 years, that same consistent over and over again, teaching you, okay, remember I taught you this. This is how you're going to do it. I taught you this. This is how you're going to do it. So that consistently probably really helped you in the first 2 years. So what happened between then and now? Because a lot's happened between then and now.
Yep.
You worked there for a couple of years, and then you moved here in 2008, and you spent a lot of time at Dodge here in Canada.
Yeah.
What was the reason for the move, and what's occurred since then to now to kind of lead
honestly,
you? Because
what happened was,
you're now at a large group and at foreman level.
Yeah. So what happened essentially was, so I had to leave him because he decided to go to school to do engineering. That was his passion, and he basically turned his business opposite. So he would literally go to school during the day at university to do engineering, and then he would come home at 5 o'clock and then do that until 11 o'clock at night. But you can't just leave a kid alone. Wow. You know, as much as a couple of times I had ran the shop here and there, you can't do it. It's not feasible, and at the same time it's not safe, especially with dumbass kid. So I had to move on. Went into a bigger shop, a lot more volume, a lot of different experienced guys, working with some old school guys that were literally smoking right over the hood as they're doing work on it. Other guys that, you know, were kind of fresh to the trade too. A lot of different experience. I got really lucky. My mentor there worked with him, and if I was ever in doubt about something, hey, this is what I think, this is where we're going. And most of mine was all mechanical. Electrical for us realistically was just strictly a fuse and then throwing scotch locks on something, which thinking back now, I'm disgusted at myself because I hate scotch locks with a passion. But you know, that's what I knew. I didn't know any different, you know. And then my parents retired in 07. They had retired in 07, and my dad used to live, in St. Catharines. So I don't know how far away from you that is. So St. Catharines and Caledon.
About 3 hours, give or take.
Okay. So he always said
my mother-in-law is from St. Catharines.
Okay. So he always said he would retire back. And he came over, and I tried living over there for a couple of years. And I was like, why don't I give Canada a try? It was here or Australia. I applied for my visa here, and I had applied for there. I could get in either one. I was like, screw it, I'll come over here, give it a try. It's big enough. If one place isn't good enough for me, somewhere else, or I'll try going down in the States. You know, I was only 22 at the time, I think. I came over and landed in New Brunswick. So everyone, of course, why New Brunswick? That's where my parents were, couldn't turn down free rent. You know,
yeah, rent is hard to pass up.
Exactly. So I just kind of did my own thing, enjoyed, like, I moved over in late June, did my own thing for about a month, just checking out the city. I lived in Moncton, New Brunswick. Awesome little place. Lots of friendly people there. Coming from London, where you say hi to people and they kind of like snarl at you, like, what the hell do you want? Coming over, you say hi to someone, it's like, oh, hey, how you doing? You know? Or as I had learned, Moncton's also a bilingual city. So coming from London, it was like, hello, like, hello, how you doing? They assumed I was French. So, blah, 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 blah. Well, sorry, no parlay.
No.
So, anyways,
Je ne
great little
parle pas. What is it? Je
city.
ne parle pas français or something like that? Yeah.
Don't know. I know enough to get me in trouble. So,
Same.
I came, just took the month, relax, just check out the place, you know, see what it's like. And yeah, start applying for jobs. And the previous year, before I came over, I had handed out my resume every single dealership in town. Hey, I'm coming over next year. Hey, I'm coming over next year. Just lay that seed. Come around, see the guys again. And I decided the dealerships was job security. I didn't know what things were going to be like for me, so I went with dealership. Let's give myself some job security as opposed to a small shop. I don't know what's going to happen. I've already had one shop that he changed his life, which affected my life. You know, not indirectly, but anyways. And yeah, it just happened to be
Hey,
there's
it's
a
a logical.
dealership
Hey, don't knock that, man, because that's a logical step. You know, there are some folks that they're trying to decide, like, you know, think 16, 17, 18, 19-year-old men and women who, you know, like, I want to turn a wrench. I want to go work on cars. I want to fix stuff for a living. Where's the best place for me to go? And given your circumstances, the fact that you spent 2 years of your life committed to an individual, to a shop, to learning your trade. And then all of a sudden, this person has literally turned their life upside down as a small shop owner. It's like, no, I'm not going to be a small shop anymore as a standard of practice that you would normally expect from a small shop. And now I'm out of a job. Like, from that point of view, it kind of makes sense to go to a larger store, a branded store that seems to have security.
Yeah, no, absolutely, you know, and so I applied to everywhere, and one of the it was a smaller of the two Chrysler dealerships in town, and they were like, hey, can you get your toolbox here on Monday? I was like, yeah, I'll go buy one because I just shipped all my tools over in crates. So okay, yeah, wear a crappy tire, go buy myself a roll cab and show up, unload everything. And it was an eye-opener, especially like, hey, flat rate, hey this, like everything, like now you're on the clock. And I had a good crew to work with. There was only six of us in the shop, and most of those guys had worked together for about 20 plus years. Like they literally had grown up together. They played hockey together. They used to go to the bars together. Like, you know, when they were all dating their wives, they were just friends together kind of deal, you know. And it was great to be part of that. You know, it was probably the best shop I've ever been part of, just for the camaraderie of how everyone was in it for each other. You know, sure, you have that day where you know, you're looking at the bay next to you and you're like, how come he's getting all that good stuff and there I am getting the crap? But you know, you understand seniority, you understand that, well, this is how it's been, and some shops they never change. But it gave me lots of opportunity. I got to learn electrical. I had an awesome guy, John. John was the electrician there, and just to learn from him, we would talk about stuff like so I remember they gave me once, it was a 06 LX, so it was a 300, and they gave me for a CAN bus problem. And I was like, I'm not a doctor, I can't deal with that. Just follow the service information, and if you get stuck anywhere, John will help you. Oh, okay. I already had an idea how to go through service information, and he'd already laid the seeds in with me with regards to checking your TSBs for every problem you have. Check RRTs, you know, even just when you open the computer in the morning, have a look at what's coming out. So therefore, you're ahead of what's coming in. Anyways, go through it all, stumbled through it, you know, hey, look, this is where I'm going, this is what I'm thinking. Yeah, you're bang on. And there's other times it's like, why haven't you done this? Why haven't you done that? Well, this is my result. Okay, I learned then, voltmeter you can't trust. Can it power a light bulb? You know, Just mm-hmm. little things like that that were missing from my early years, he filled in those voids for me. I got to learn transmissions.
That tidbit right there that you just said, that tidbit right there, voltmeter versus will it power a headlight? Did you then, the first time that he said that to you, did you find a used headlight and put leads on it so you then had your own?
I had a bulb, yes. Just a bulb on its own. Bulb with two wires stuck out of it that I had soldered to, and that done me for a while, up until my last shop that I was at, one of the guys actually made me a fog lamp holder and completely sealed beam, so therefore you can actually, you know, not worry about it in the winter.
When I first heard that similar yep. statement from my first foreman, I had literally just yanked a headlight off of the owner's old D100. Oh God, it's been so long now, I can't remember. 1990 Dodge truck. I am for some reason completely gapping. It's like a D100 or a D150 or something like that. And he was his plow truck. So on the back, because he couldn't see to back up, and obviously it's a Dodge dealership and there's lots of cars, brand new cars out, and he didn't want to hit anything when he backed up. He had put one of those old school chrome lights that was like this big around in the back.
Yeah.
Mounted it to the box and faced it. So he had a little switch in the car, or sort of switch in the truck that he'd flip it on so that it would come on. Either on all the time, or it would just come on when the reverse light's on. Well, he figured out that when it came on with reverse lights, it would kill the frickin' fuse and so on and so forth. So he went to a switch. Anyway, I had just yanked it off because the truck was going bye-bye. So I have this big old chrome light that I put leads that were already attached with wires that became my headlight tester. I still have that thing. I got to remember to make a post about that. That's to show everybody what that looks like. But yes, the don't necessarily trusting the voltmeter when you need to make sure it'll power something that like draw out comes the headlight.
That applies to everything other than ABS diagnosis on any late model RAM.
Yes.
I don't know why it passed. Like, you can have a bad, guaranteed bad wire and it will pass every electrical test that you give it, but you will find a corroded, broken wire. I have no idea how it makes sense.
Agreed. Agreed, and that's why it became so useful, because I don't know whether it's a Dodge-specific thing, but I didn't find that to be the case anytime I worked on any Toyotas, any imports for that matter. I don't think Hondas, Toyotas, Kias, anytime I ever touched them, if it failed the electrical test of some kind, but you could do it with a voltmeter. But as soon as you work on a Dodge, for some reason, it's like there's always one strand of wire holding on for absolutely dear life that will still somehow make the voltmeter give you good reading. So I don't know. Maybe absolutely. Dodge is built better, or that's actually worse. I'm not sure. Yeah. I don't know.
It's got survival instincts.
Yes. So you're working at Dodge, and you've got this small, and you're at the small shop. You got six guys. They've been together forever. How did you go from working for Dodge to now for a long time? So much so, and so well so, that you went to national championships, that now you're working at an import store.
So there was a little bit in between. So I worked there for about 4 years, and then I decided to come west. This was right around the time I had a young family, decided to use my level 3, or at the time level 4 training. Don't hear that phrase doctor in house anymore with Chrysler. Used that to my advantage to come out here, and there was a company in town that gave me an opportunity. So I was like, yeah, you know what? It sounds like a great fit. Didn't play out too well for me, just more so I was playing second fiddle to everyone else. So I went from being the transmission diesel guy, you know, doing all the engine re-reads and stuff, to then remember when the 6.7, around, this would have been 2012 was having all the O2 issues.
When they went to the big,
So when they were coming out with all the harnesses, the pit, like Does it have like the gold pins and so forth for the overlay, for the smart module, etc.? I was getting all the scraps, you know. Somebody else is doing all like the EGR cleans, all the gravy stuff. There's me getting the scraps. The only way I could make money in that shop was doing maintenance and inspections, which I take pride in doing the challenging stuff as much as, you know, there's no knocking on maintenance inspections. You make money doing it. It's just I wanted to challenge myself. I wanted to push myself. You know, you don't go from challenging other technicians from around your province and region to then just be like, yeah, sure, I'll just service your brakes. I'll change your U-joint, whatever. So made the switch to the other dealership in town, and it was just complete 180. I was there for about 10 years, made it up to assistant shop foreman. There was a crew of 17. So made it up to assistant shop foreman, and I had made it known many times, I want to progress. I want to progress. I want to progress. And my service manager always told me, techs make the worst service managers. You know, you think about the tech as opposed to you think about the bottom line. Which, okay, you know what? I understand it now because here I am going.
I that phrase is so very wrong on so many levels. I understand his thought process, but the data supports like the top 20 service managers, like NADA did a analysis on this many years ago. The top 20% service managers in the country, 80% of them were former techs. So his phrase about technicians making the worst service managers is,
and it could have been just, you know, it could have been just his way of just trying
might
to
be the case.
No, like it could be that it could be just a way of trying to keep on to one of your guys, you know, just different ideologies, different way of thinking. Okay, if I squish this now, I've still got one of my top guys for longer. You know, because. Mm-hmm. We weren't in that situation back then. Back then, we could find bad help. Now in the trade, finding terrible help is impossible. But anyways, I was there for, like I say, it was 10 years, system foreman, told him that I wanted to do that, and made it up to the point of where I was involved in training. I was involved in helping the apprentices. There was myself and two other journeymen that we were trying to help the foreman, because you can't have one guy running 17 guys. We're trying to help him out with the apprentices, so therefore the apprentices were getting the learning that they had, because it was too much for him. We helped out. Then they made me up. Okay, you're now responsible for apprentices. You're now responsible for making sure people get their training. So coming around every day on the 28th of every bloody month. Hey, did you get your master tech done? No. Get it done. You know, having that same conversation until eventually people were like sick and tired of hearing that conversation. And it was great, you know, like helping with the apprentices, actually getting more involved in that aspect. And then it just happened to be that my current GM now reached out to me on LinkedIn and was like, hey, would you be interested in coming here? I was like, honestly, if I'm going to leave, I'm leaving for a full foreman position. I knew if I took the foreman job at that place that I was at, I feel as though that was too many bodies for me to be responsible as afresh. As much as it was my crew, as much as, you know, I would have had the respect of my peers, it would have been too much for me, in my personal opinion. You know, start small, no different than anyone that starts off with their own business in this industry, doesn't just start out with a 10-base shop. It's themselves. Then they progress 2-3 base, so forth, right? So he explained everything to me. Like, hey, you know what? I'm not going to lie to you. Like, things are a bit of a mess right now. We do have a new building coming. This is the plan. This is that. We talked back and forth a few times. And what really sold me outside of his honesty, which is honestly rare from a dealership perspective, the amount of times that I've been lied to in interviews, you know, everyone's making 230 hours. And then when you actually look at it, it's one guy's making it. And then there's everyone else falls short less than 80%. Or in order to get 230, you've got to put in 300. And what sold it for me was that as part of the group, there's multiple service managers that are former techs. I came from a group that essentially being a tech, it was near impossible to get through that wall. If you're a salesman, you'll be promoted to no end. That because it was a company created by salesmen for salesmen. This company understands you need to have strengths and weaknesses. Where's your weaknesses? Okay, let's improve on that. So like Brandon, who you had, well, Brandon, mm-hmm. who Brandon had reached out, inadvertently put you through to, he's a former tech. He's a former master tech for Acura, Honda. He'd been VW and so forth. So different experiences of brands.
Uh-huh.
Okay, cool. Understand. And yeah, things are going great. You know, we moved into a new building in June. Like I started in January. We moved into a new building in June. And yeah, things are going great with the group.
Nice. Nice. It's nice to hear a continued experiences, good experiences at a dealer. Continued experiences that show there are high value leaders out there that are looking for a quality team that works together, that builds from within, that build programs for apprentices, because even in your past, you know, you had a team set up by leadership. Okay, this is what we're going to build from within. We're going to build our apprentices up. We're going to turn them into like our producing, healthy, crushing technicians over a period of time. And now you're moving into another role, to the full role where you're now responsible for everyone on the floor, fully responsible for training to build apprentices from within. And you have leaders who have a vision of building from within. That's awesome to see. I see them posting on a regular basis. They're building from within. An entire training regimen around building leadership from within. And to hear that other service managers, like I asked and said before, the top service managers, the cream of the crop, the majority of them are technicians. I've had technicians tell me in coaching sessions, like, what am I going to do after? I've been a tech for 10 years. What am I going to do? I might get show foreman. I might do that. I might have to fight because there's five other techs in the shop that have more experience than me, but I want to be the next foreman. It's like, okay, well, these are the things that you got to do to get this. Oh no, I'm never going to get that. I'm never going to do that. It's like, I can name drop like five or six people off the top of my head right now that were technicians that started at the bottom, pushing a broom, shoveling shit, that are now service managers, fixed ops directors, service directors, fixed ops directors of multiple stores. There are general managers now that I know that were technicians at the very start of their career. There is now managing partners who were technicians. And that's just inside a store. Like that's not talking about all of the other things that you can do outside of the dealership with your trade skills. And I've written about it. I've talked about it. I've made lots of content about it, but I have to keep reiterating, our career development doesn't stop once we become a technician. There are so many things at our disposal after we become a technician that you can move towards. You just have to figure out, you know, what you like to do. It's like, okay, I've been a technician for 5 to 10 years. Okay, at the 10-year mark, do I still want to be full-time turning a wrench? Or do I want to go towards the diagnostic sort of thing? Do I want to not spend as much time doing the repair end? Do I want to focus on electrical diagnostics? Well, how do I do that? Well, A, you got to be upskilling on your diagnostic skills outside of what the technical at the brand is teaching you. And you got to get to a store big enough to have a dedicated electrical diagnostic technician. You're not going to get that at a 10-bay shop. You're going to get it at a 40-bay shop. I can tell you right now, there are service managers and fixed ops directors that would absolutely kill for a pure, unadulterated electrical diagnostician that all they did all day is walk around the shop with a diagnostic cart with diagnostic electrical equipment in it. And that's all they did all day. Obviously, you're looking for zero comebacks, well-written stories, never getting audited for diagnostics and things like that.
Yep.
Just because you say you're an electronic diagnostician means that you also need to be doing these things, but you have to be focusing on that. You have to find yourself into that shop and so on and so forth. So it's happy. It makes me happy to hear you say that, A, it's happening. B, that's really cool that it's happening here in Canada because some of our shops are smaller. Most of our shops are smaller by proportion than our friends down south.
Yeah.
So that's really awesome. To that end, you're now there. You're now crushing it out as a foreman there. What would you say since your start now to now? What would be one piece of advice that you've learned along the way that could maybe help a technician or mechanic along the way to be happier, healthier, and more productive tomorrow?
Find something to get your to unwind away from it. This is a very mentally stressing job, especially when you get onto it. If you hold yourself accountable, if you take pride in your work, you know, you want to do your training, you want to, you're thinking about the clock. You know, like you're talking about your times of where mark it on the board every time you walk back and forth for a tool. We're always thinking about stuff. Can find an outlet for you outside of work. You know, like I've gone through my different stages, you know, I went through the typical, let's try alcohol, let's try this, let's try that. Now I've moved into fitness. Fitness seems to be the one thing that's working for me. Like, you know, I jump on the treadmill, I just try and unwind away from it. And then I put a hockey game on and then bang, my stress is back because apparently these millionaires I shout at through the TV are, you know.
As long as you're not trying to cheer for the Leafs who haven't won a cup God only knows how long, because the stress level for any true, honest to goodness Leaf fan is just, I can't, I watch hockey from time to time. But I haven't had cable in almost 15 years. So yeah. I haven't watched hockey religiously since basically I was a kid, right? Watching on the sofa with my dad and my grandfather, watching the Leafs lose, or more importantly, the standard of practice for a Leaf fan is blow a 3-1 lead. Like third period, middle of third period, it's 3-1, and somehow they lose 4-3 by the end of the period. That is a standard of practice for the Leafs. That kind of stress I don't need in my life.
Yep. No, unfortunately, I'm an Oilers fan, so that's where I'm at right now.
Yeah.
Because they're not off to a good start so far this year.
No. And right now, the only thing that I seem to get on my feed is Connor Bedard absolutely shelving stuff with like the look away. What was it? Was it Saturday? When was that? It must have been last weekend. The flip the stick, pull it to backhand, look to the left side of the ice, and then roof it. Like, it was just mind-blowing watching this rookie on his, yep, like, second or third game completely obliterate. It's like, okay, that's awesome. What about the Leafs? Well, nobody's covering the Leafs. Yep. Bedard is, anyway, I digress.
But absolutely, like that's my thing is, like, this is such a stressful industry, especially if you're somebody that takes it on yourself to try and make things better. So find your outlet, mm-hmm, outside of it. I preach that to my apprentices in the terms of just sooner or later, this job will get more stressful for you. It won't be me on you trying to hold you accountable for your repairs with the small details. It's going to be sooner or later, you know, you're thinking about it. Okay, I'm running over on my diag. Oh, I've had a bit of a rough day and I've done a whole bunch of vehicles. And if I look at my hours, I'm only got 2.5 hours today. But the way flat rate works, it swings and, mm-hmm, what is it? Swings and falls or ebbs and flows. Right. You know, I was like that for years at Chrysler. My first 10, 15 days of the month, I look at my hours and I just like, whatever, because I knew parts would arrive, this would arrive, bang, 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 you know, engines getting replaced, transmissions getting rebuilt, you know, services finally approved and showed up, etc. Everything else was on the back nine.
And you do things like, you know, you finish an engine, now going back small shop kind of mentality, a small shop, you don't have like 3 service advisors, a fully dedicated warranty admin, a fully dedicated cashier, like you don't necessarily have those in a small shop. So when you finish an engine job, it's not like all of a sudden magically that engine job that's probably going to be like 20 to 30 hours of time that's in there. Those people have to read your stories. They have to go through, they have to make sure the Like, when done properly, it might take an engine dub probably an hour, whoever's doing it, probably an hour to 2 hours of dedicated time reviewing all the notes, reviewing all the parts, making sure everything's correct, to get it booked and closed before you get paid. If you finish an engine job at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, the likelihood that it gets paid today or even tomorrow might be slim. So then you're stressing about it because let's say that's Wednesday afternoon that you finish that engine job off. Come Friday, come payday, it may not make that paycheck. It may have to wait until the following week because they just don't have time to book it, right? Book it properly, especially booking it properly so that they don't get any chargebacks. Like, it's a big deal. It's a whole process. And there's a lot of technicians that I've spoken to in the last year and a half that don't necessarily understand that, especially when you start to get to somewhere in the middle. Now, I've said this before, but just to reiterate a little bit, the hardest shops to run are the shops between about 6 and about 15 technicians. And that's the bulk of the shops out there. And the reason why they're so hard to run the reason why they're so hard to run is because you don't generate enough revenue to pay for enough bodies to do things singularly. Like having a dedicated warranty admin, like having a dedicated internal advisor, like having dedicated people that can go and crack on 20, 30, 40 ROs at the end of the day to make sure they're closed. So until you hit a certain threshold of revenue as a shop, so think about this, technicians, as you're listening, until you have about 15 technicians, somewhere between 13 and 15, depending on the shop, the brand, so on and so forth, between 13 and 15 technicians, do they start generating enough revenue to pay for unique people in service to make things easier for everybody? So if you're in a shop right now, let's say with 10 techs, I'm willing to bet that your service manager, even if they're an amazing high-value leader, they're pulling their hair out, trying to find ways to make enough money so that they can maybe hire someone to do warranty and maybe do internal ROs and maybe do service writing on a Saturday. They're pulling their head out, doing everything they possibly can to hire that person. But you got to make just enough money to justify it, because gross and net and everything else that goes all into it. If you don't know anything about that, the technicians that come to me to talk about this, it's like, well, why don't they just hire somebody? It's like it's not that easy.
Nope.
Let's talk about business a little bit. So I'm happy to hear you reiterate, because I know there's probably about 5, and I can't remember them all. There's probably about 5 in since we started the Wrench Turners podcast that have said you need some form of external outlet to relieve stress. And that isn't addiction, right? Because that is something that we've both seen. Instead of relieving stress in a healthy way, relieving stress in a not healthy way makes all of it worse. And I'm working on trying to find a way to communicate about that in the future to try and put some things in perspective, because our industry also sees a lot of that as well. Because of the pressure.
It's almost as if it's just an acceptance, you know, like, you know, for myself, I, at one point here, in my previous relationship, I was working out here. I think I was doing typically about 25 and 7. We used to be open 7 days a week. So I do 25 days straight. And most of the time I was renting a room, finish work at 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock at night. Sometimes I was there till 1 o'clock in the morning. And it was just, if I finished at 8, grab one of the advisors that just happened that he had nobody else in town. Hey, let's go have a couple of beers. And next thing you know, like, you know, 1, 2 turns into 5. And then I had it a few times myself where I got lucky where I've had people around me to check. But it got to the point where I had, on the weekends, one of my assistant managers would actually walk up to me. Hey man, how's it going? How was your day? Blah, blah, blah. And after about a couple of minutes, he's like, okay, you're not going on a road test until after lunch. You need a road test. Grab an apprentice. They will drive for you. Okay. And it was little wake up calls like that for me that, you know, okay, taking this, I'm just taking the easy way out per se. You know, it was just easier to forget my day. Let's get rid of it, you know. So I've been trying different things to work with it, especially with now I've gone from putting that stress on, making my money, this. Now it's okay. I just had it a couple of weeks ago where my manager took 2 weeks off for his new baby. So I was running the shop, I was running dispatch, I was trying to organize with sa trying to organize sales with trying to get approvals for any estimates and stuff. You're better off herding cats. It just all that extra stuff, and it's just like, you know what, I'm gonna come home, like I'm trying this journey for myself, but it's okay, jump on the elliptical, throw some weights around if you really feel like that need of just pushing an extra couple of reps or something to take that vent out, so therefore you can go to bed and try and get some proper sleep and then rinse, repeat, rinse, repeat.
I really appreciate you sharing that.
Yep, no problem.
I don't discredit that, because there's a lot of folks out there, and I've talked to a few, but I think there's a lot of folks out there that need to hear that they're not alone. They're going through some struggles. It might be addiction, it might be something else, but understand that you're not alone. If you need some help, not always necessarily going to be as lucky as Andrew to have somebody that, because that could have gone not so well.
100%, 100%. I could have easily, jumped in a vehicle, being where I am. We got a lot of blow boxes. So imagine you bring in your vehicle for service, and then the guy working on it blows over, and now you're getting in trouble for it, or you're getting a phone call and be like, "Hey, how come this is locked out? I don't have my vehicle. I'm on the other side of the country right now. I left my vehicle for 2 weeks to get repaired." Right? Many, many consequences that without even thinking about it.
Those are consequences. Those are very real consequences for very real actions. And everyone needs to hear that it's not the figment of your imagination. It's not a story from somebody from another world, or it's happening around us, right? There, we've both been around people who don't get the message. You got the message. Like, I'm thankful for you. I'm thankful for everybody around you. I'm thankful for all those things that happened to put you in a scenario where you realized something wasn't right. You didn't necessarily realize. It wasn't necessarily even that you were wrong, but you realized that something wasn't occurring the way it should, and you made a meaningful decision to change something. Doesn't matter what it was about the circumstances, but you made a meaningful decision to change something. Not everybody gets that message the same way. Not everybody gets the message at all, whether it's them or from an outside source, it doesn't matter. But some aren't so lucky. I think that is so, I'm almost at a loss for words at this point, because there are so many that need to hear that message.
No, absolutely.
It's not okay to resort to certain things, and understanding that there are alternatives, there are people, there are agencies out there willing to help you through whatever it is you're going through. That's ultimately why I started Wrench Turners. I wanted it to be a source of information, to be a resource for people to reach out to say, "Hey, I'm having these challenges. Can you help me?" If I can't help, I'm trying to build a network of people who can, or a series of content that can, or whatever. Reach out. If it doesn't matter if you went through the same thing that Andrew went through. If you are having a challenge and you don't know how to get through it, reach out. And if I can't help, I'll try and direct you to somebody who can, to get you through whatever the next step and happens to be. Thank you for sharing that.
You're very welcome.
I think that's a great way to finish. So I really appreciate you taking the time, Andrew. I really do. I really appreciate you sharing some really deep life experience in the trade and giving me the time.
No, thank you very much for having me on here. You know, I'm happy to help out, and if it helps anyone else, or just even understanding that, you know, there are options out there, or even just alternatively career-wise, there isn't just a brick wall. You can get through it. You just gotta, simple thing that was taught to me as a kid, you don't ask, you don't get.
Awesome. Hey folks, that's the end of today's episode for Wrench Turner's podcast. That's okay though, folks. There will be another episode coming in 2 weeks. Reach out for that. You gotta hit that notification bell. Make sure you get notified when that comes out. And don't forget that Wrench Turner's merch is now available. You can find that link in the bio on LinkedIn or below in both Spotify and YouTube. The Wrench Turner's, more specifically the Wrenches for Wrenches newsletter, comes out every 2 weeks. Comes out on LinkedIn for free as a blurb, and it comes out full on premium content if you go and sign up on wrenchturners.online. And new content comes out every day on LinkedIn. Make sure you subscribe for that. Folks, really appreciate you turning in. And our quote for the week, as always, on Wrench Turners Podcast: you are not a burden for seeking help for your mental health. Folks, remember, negative pushes, positive pulls, and always clean your toys before you put them away.